All right, let's do a check on this. It's the 29th of October in Minneapolis, talking to Poole Anderson. Just heard you give a couple of readings. I'm curious, how do you select the things that you read at these things, or is there any particular modus operandi? Well, I might hold it because I have to go back.
Yeah, well, of course, one obvious parameter is simply time. I was looking over some possible stories, and some of them were simply too long for the time available. And then, of course, in this appropriateness of theme in this particular case, I felt it should be a fantasy story of some kind, and preferably one that would be new to the audience. So since I didn't have any new fantasies, I went back to a collection of stuff old enough that probably nobody would have seen it.
And the title of your story was the first one?
Pact.
Pact.
P-A-C-T.
Okay, now, when we talk about Poole Anderson, I suppose people who come to a convention like the...
Wait a minute. Come on in!
When you come to this convention as a guest of honor, it's not really by accident, because your roots, your writing roots, are here. You were apparently part of a group of young writers who came out of Minnesota in general. Maybe if you could summarize a little bit those roots and the young writers that you knew then that are still writing today.
Well, there were, Minneapolis was for a long time quite a center for writers, including science fiction writers. And before my time, there was a science fiction fan group, Minneapolis Fantasy Society, which more or less sat at the feet of Clifford Simak. And, of course, there were other writers around, Donald Wandre and others. Well, then the war came along. Most of the members of the society went off to war. And when they came back, they were not boys any longer, but young men. But they were still interested in science fiction and wanted to reconstitute the society, which they did, and that was when I joined. And it was more a group of, just a group of friends than anything else, but some of us did have such interests.
How far was that from where we're sitting now, where you were first getting together with these folks and starting to write your stories after the war?
Oh, we used to meet either in each other's homes or else in a sort of a low-life downtown bar. And anyway, there were some people who had, even before their military service, you know, as quite young fellows, had sold a few stories, Oliver Sorry, John Chapman, so on. And then in the post-war group, I was mainly Gordon Dixon and myself. We were the ones who were really interested in writing. There were one or two others who were interested and would sort of cheer each other on, but those other people eventually went into different lines of work.
Because of this region, were a fair number of you Czech, Scandinavian, Norwegian, German in heritage, etc.?
Oh, more or less, although we didn't make any big thing of it, usually.
Mm-hmm. How about the regional aspect of this area? Was that always, was that an element in your writing as well, or were you trying to get off the planet, as it were?
Well, in those days, I was mainly trying to get off the planet. Since then, I find myself increasingly harking back. And Gordon Dixon, likewise, I think, I'd consider his book Wolf and Iron a very good regional novel by any standard.
Well, and in fact, I'm curious now among your own works if you have done something that you also consider as a regional work.
Well, to some extent, a novel called recently reprinted in paperback called There Will Be Time starts out its first several chapters in a small Minnesota town, more or less modeled on Northfield, which I think of as my hometown, in the 1940s and 1950s. And occasionally, in other stories, parts of it might take place, parts of a story might take place in the this area as people pass through, or somebody might hail from this area.
What kind of a young man were you in these days right after the war? What was on your mind?
Me? Oh, well, actually, my ambition was to become a scientist. I majored in physics at the university, and I thought I might, at most, that I might moonlight at writing. But I sold a couple of stories while I was still in college, and then graduated into a recession where jobs were hard to find and there was no money left to pursue graduate studies. So, being a bachelor who had not had a chance to develop expensive tastes, I thought I would support myself by writing while I looked around for honest employment. And somehow the search got less and less diligent, and you know, at last I realized that a writer was, after all, what nature had cut me out to be.
But that was a realization that came later. You were not burning to write in the first place.
Not really, except to the extent, of course, that it was something I really liked to do. But I thought of it as, at that time, as more a hobby, an extremely interesting hobby, than as a life work.
And who were you reading that may have been an influence in those days?
Oh, fairly widely. There were the giants of the science fiction's golden age, the Campbell golden age, so-called, of course. But outside of that, various writers who I think became considerable influences on me, not that I pretend to be that good, but Homer, the classical Greeks, Icelandic Eddas and Sagas, King James Bible, Shakespeare, in more coming up to more modern times, Kipling and Conrad, and some of these Scandinavians.
Having a narrow reading was never part of your agenda. I mean, that wide kind of background is always very obvious in your work.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. I mean, it would get awfully boring to read the same thing all the time.
Let's talk now about things like Vault of the Ages. Now, was that your very first novel?
It was the first one of mine to see print. It was not the first published novel I ever actually wrote. That was The Broken Sword, but it took a long time to find a publisher. Back in that era, that was before heroic fantasy had become a genre. Nobody quite knew what to do with it.
And maybe you didn't know what to do with it yet either.
Well, it simply circulated, and eventually it found a publisher. But meanwhile, a couple of other things had appeared.
Tell me the story of... Let's stay first, then, with Broken Sword. Summarize, if you would, the story of it, and then some of the way that you synthesized so many legends into this narrative.
Well, it went back to my reading of the old Icelandic literature. A number of motifs come in there. And to to some extent also the more modern, I won't say modern, but later medieval fairy tales, the glittering courts of fairy and so on. And the sword itself, you know, the accursed sword is found in one of the Icelandic sagas, Heiðrek the Wise, and as a matter of fact, the grave mound scene in the Broken Sword is also adapted from that particular source. And then there's just the general historical background. Sort of fatalism of the pagan Nordic faith.
So many of those elements that you've just described, modern readers are so familiar with over 40, 50 years of fantasy reading.
Mm-hmm.
But you probably had not read anything quite like that when you wrote this, correct?
No, I think not. I certainly don't recall it. Various children's things, of course, but not the same. I can't remember the author, but there was a very evocative children's book called The Wee Men of Ballywood, and about some Irish fairy folk. And those had some influence. As a matter of fact, if I remember rightly, the Broken Sword came out in America the same year as the first volume of Tolkien's Lord of the Rings came out in England. Pure coincidence, of course. Uh-huh. Neither of us had heard of the other.
Right. Now, were you aware at the time that you were writing this that maybe you were on to something, as it were?
Pardon?
Were you aware when you were first writing this that you were on to something?
Well, it was just a story I wanted to tell.
In fact, that's pretty much the way it should be, isn't it?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Why did you revise it, and when did that happen?
Oh, that happened, I forget exactly when, many years afterward. The first version had only a single printing. You know, it really went nowhere. People who had read it would come up to me and mention it. That, you know, it had a, you might say, almost a very small cult of its own. And so eventually, when Ballantine Books was getting up its adult fantasy series, Lynn Carter, who was running it then, approached me. He simply wanted to reprint the novel as it was, but I looked it over, you know, and sort of winced at what seemed to me some pretty crudely written sections. I mean, I should hope I had learned a good bit about writing since then. So I said, hey, look, why not just let me do it all over again end to end? And it's the same story, but I just hope I found somewhat better words.
There are some writers, if I might suggest, that maybe should be barred from revising their earlier work. Did you have any apprehensions at all?
No. I mean, I think that was very much an improvement. It's not something I would propose to do ordinarily, you know, rather than to let my literary sins lie where they fall and go on to something new. Well, this was a rather special case.
Now, I saw a copy of Vault of the Ages for $150 mm-hmm. downstairs. I've never read Vault of the Ages. What is that all about?
Well, frankly, don't bother. It was, there I was, living hand to mouth, selling stories to magazines now and then, which weren't paying much. And that particular publisher, Winston, I think it was getting up a series of juvenile science fiction books, and I got an offer to write one. I was more or less handed the plot, you know, would you care to write something about a barbaric post-World War III future where they stumble on time capsule and so on? I said, well, all right. But it was frankly a potboiler, and then it got ineptly copy edited. I never got a look at the copy edited manuscript. So I frankly don't think much of it myself.
You know, that series, though, sure was a lot of fun for kids of my age.
Oh, yes, yes. And by the way, I'm saying nothing against any of the others in the series. Or there were some books. Chad Oliver, for example, did a very good one. I'm just saying I don't think highly of my own.
When we were talking about regional books a while ago, I thought you were going to suggest that maybe Brainwave was, because so much of Brainwave is in an area like this. And I think it's a remarkable novel for a writer so young. Mm-hmm. It's a very mature... Well, talk to me about Brainwave.
Oh, well, thank you. Nice to hear you say so. Yeah, I think about that time I was beginning to hit my stride. I'd acquired basic techniques and so on. It would probably have helped if I'd... let me cut back. When young people who want to be writers ask me for advice, there's very little I can tell them, really. But one thing I say is, you know, if you're going to college, fine. Major in anything that interests you, especially if it will give you a means to earn a living, except creative writing. I've seen too many promising talents smothered under that load of theory. However, I won't deny that in my early stages, I would have been the better for some informed criticism and counsel. I had to learn a lot of things for myself the hard way. So by the time Brainwave came along, though, I think I had learned at least some things. And
well, in fact, our young hero learns quite a lot, too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I was, of course, attempting an inherently impossible job. How do you write about a superhuman intellect? So to show it in its very birth, when it's still trying to find itself, was in a way cheating.
Mm-hmm. But and there's that dilemma too in it about when you achieve a certain level of knowledge and you detach from your fellows, that is quite a price to pay.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder if science fiction writers ever feel that, or people of intellect at all. It was almost something tragic in that.
Well, I suppose so. There was a psychological study done, many years ago. I think it was back when I was still living here in Minneapolis. Various writers were asked by mail if they'd be willing to take, I think it was a Minnesota multiphasic. Mm. And no, all right, you know, I was curious. They promised me, you know, they promised participants in exchange that you know, you'd get a copy of the report. So I took part. And the finding was that science fiction writers as of that time did have certain psychological distinctions, significant statistical distinctions from other kinds. As I remember, what were the terms? They did seem to tend to be slightly aloof personalities with inner directed tendency toward abstract thinking and so on. But it wasn't I don't think it was very strong, and certainly I've known all sorts of personality types within the field, and for that matter, intellectual occupations generally, whom it would not fit in the least, especially nowadays when the field is so big. You know, there's an awful lot of people writing it, and so, of course, there's bound to be a wide range of personality types. Actually, most of the people I've met whom I consider really bright are right out there in the world.
Do you think that the expansion of our intelligence and sensibilities is as unlimited as you seem to suggest our expansion into the universe is? I mean, is there a correlation there? That is, it's essentially an open form, always ongoing.
Well, no, I mean, I don't think the... And anthropologists generally agree the human animal hasn't changed significantly since more what's usually called Cro-Magnon man, 30, 40,000 years. And for that matter, Neanderthal man apparently wasn't that different from us. So I think we're basically the same species with the same limitations.
So brainwave is more wishful thinking, maybe, in your mind.
Yeah, or playing with the idea. Yeah, yes. I have in other stories explored the idea of artificially enhancing human intelligence. Or in a novel called The Avatar, for example, looking into the possibility of direct interfacing between computers and the human brain.
And we have some of that in Boat of a Million Years, too, I believe.
Yes. And, you know, this is a very interesting frontier. And, of course, things might be done with genetics, although myself, I would be very, very wary of tinkering with the human genome, and certainly I'd be against doing anything that would have psychological effects, such as tinkering with brain structure. We're just not wise enough to handle that. It's going to happen anyway. You know, I mean, if it's possible, it will be done. But
it's funny about saying we're not wise enough to handle the expansion of our brains.
Yeah, just so.
Sort of paradox in that.
Every time I tune in and recall programs on television like Time Tunnel and Quantum Leap and all of that, of course I think of Guardians in Time, the prototype there of delving back in and out of periods of time. I don't know that I've ever read a series of stories before yours, however, where that theme was taken up so fully as you did in those. Is that fair?
Perhaps not. Right offhand, I can't think of anything else. What I set out to do basically, to tell a set of stories that I hope would be entertain readers. That's always the fiction writer's first obligation, I think. But entertainment, of course, doesn't have to mean just mindless pastime.
There's some mind-boggling paradoxes in some of them.
Yeah. So with that motif, that particular motif of the necessity of policing the time lanes gave rise to a number of different stories, and of course, what I particularly liked about it was showing various historical eras as accurately as I could render them, but through the eyes of essentially a very ordinary mid-20th century Midwestern fellow. In other words, take these glamorous-looking eras and put them into homely, everyday terms.
Those were collected recently in a new edition, weren't they? I think there was a new story as part of that.
Yes, there was.
Does that mean that that's going to continue to be something that you dip into occasionally?
I might. I have no such immediate plans, but I might do some more.
Mm-hmm. Well, when you see programs like I just mentioned on TV, do you wince a little bit thinking how that general theme has been taken over by popular media?
I very seldom see science fiction on TV. It seems to me there are better ways to spend one's time.
But certainly it has lent itself to the episodic television format. This week it's Rome, next week it's the Wild West.
Yes, indeed.
Yeah.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, a movie producer has taken out an option on the Time Patrol series, but whether anything will ever actually be made, I don't know. Mm-hmm. Probably not.
Is that something you'd be very apprehensive and wary of?
Well, where it comes to dealing with Hollywood, the only thing to do is take the money and run.
Well, forgive me for not knowing. Have any of your books been filmed?
No. There's one for which the actual movie rights were recently bought by a German company, of all things, a romp called The High Crusade. I'll be interested to see if they actually make it, and if so, what they make of it.
The High Crusade.
Yeah. And then there was going to be a movie of the comic Hoka stories by Gordon Dixon and myself, but that project got killed in production. Oh, that's too bad. They got Robert Block to write the script. Must be a terrific script.
Where is it?
Oh, in some vault somewhere.
When did you begin to feel that you were really making it as a writer and that this was something that you would do now the rest of your life? Was there a moment when you really began to realize it, or are you still realizing it?
No, it just kind of snuck up on me. I mean, gradually I realized, I mean, in the first place, let me back up a bit. Somewhere fairly early on, you know, I realized I was basically cut out to be a writer. But sometimes when times got hard, I had to get some kind of job just to stay afloat.
So it didn't always bring in all the bread, the writing. But where were you at that time? Were you still in Minnesota?
Oh, as a bachelor, had some odd jobs now and then, you know, just very temporary things. After I got married and the baby came along, the market was in a really bad state at that time. We were broken in debt, and I had to scrabble around, so I got a job as a very junior grade chemist in a laboratory. That lasted about a year, and I'd write evenings and weekends. And
when was that, General?
Oh, that must have been about 1954, 55. No, a bit later, 50, I think 56.
Around that time, or just before you had married Karen?
No, after. I mean, we were married and had a kid.